Race Forward, an in-depth look at race relations from voices in our community. A special presentation of Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600.
My very best friend from South Africa, Charles Foya, is here this morning. And Charles is originally from Zimbabwe, lived in South Africa a long period of time, and now lives in Europe. And Charles, thanks for being here this morning. How are you?
I'm great, and thank you for having me on this evening in London.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time. So, first of all, Charles, talk about growing up in Africa.
Beautiful place. You know, as a kid, you grow up kind of not really well aware of the world around you, or your parents would try to shield you away from, you know, from the things that are out there. I mean, racism as a whole, if I think about it, in Africa, wasn't something that I thought about the most or really had many discussions on, mainly because, one, you have, you know, 98% of the population is black. So you don't really have that, you know, black-white racial issues growing up. But then, because there was this history that I was not involved in or was a part of growing up, I grew up post-independence. So we never really got to see that whole black and white division. But you heard about them, mm-hmm. You know, or if you go to a private school, that's when you realize, oh, we have, you know, different small communities.
Yeah. Now, I know when I came to South Africa, which is where you and I met back in 2011, one of the biggest things that we learned about literally as soon as we touched down there was apartheid, which started back in the late 40s. And it actually didn't even come to an end until the 90s. And basically, for anyone who hasn't heard of that, it was basically separating non-white South Africans, which was the majority of the population, as you just mentioned, from white people. Now, I noticed that in South Africa, there was still this sense, because you did see a little bit more of a white population there with some of the Afrikaners, that there was a little bit of a divide that still was around.
Yeah, I mean, they call it a racial stratification. God, this was a big term. And I'm going to put it in quotes. It was a big term that people never really discussed, but they just knew it was there. Especially in my time growing up. If you look at apartheid, it was more of like it's a formalized racial discrimination. And it was everywhere in Africa. Like you said, you know, from, you know, the late 40s all the way to the 90s. I mean, South Africa got independence, I think, was it 94 or somewhere there?
Yeah, it was the mid-90s, you know? Yeah.
We were born at that time.
Right. I was a baby,
exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's what, like, so coming from Zimbabwe, moving to South Africa, that's when I was like, hold on. Something's different here, right? Because now South Africa was just fresh out of apartheid, and you have this racial stratification in the communities. Now, that was a different, you know, that was a huge, you know, when you go to different places, you say, oh, man, it was a different cultural shock. But this one, Melissa, was more like you walk in and just like, what is going on? Why is it black people are seen as the worst of the worst? At the bottom of the pyramid, basically. Seeing this racial division within the country itself was just challenging to navigate. And what made it more interesting is when you have, for example, I want to touch on us for a little bit, Melissa, like you have study abroad students who are coming in from different parts of the world with different histories. And some of them are well aware of, you know, the racial, you know, disparities between different countries. But when they come in, they also see this issue.
Now, what about when you, Charles, went from South Africa to, you know, years ago moving to Spain and now in England? Have you noticed any parallels in Europe? Have you noticed it in the U.S.?
What I noticed, especially here in the U.K., it's not like in your face as it is in the United States. It's more like it's more subtle. It's not as bad, or it's not as bad as you might see in the U.S. because in the U.S. it's in your face. Going to Spain, for example, Spain doesn't have a big minority group. So it's just like a small group of people that you'd find. That's about it. So altogether, you know, like they're quite marginalized as a whole. It's a very tiny population, and even their own movements alone don't resonate much. But then when you come to the UK, for example, where you have a population where there's a massive, they call it Black Asian Minority Ethnicity, right? The BAME group. There is a massive movement of that. these groups, these communities, you know, have come together over a whole lot, like, you know, stretch of decades, trying to push for progressive measures. But comparing it to what I see down in South Africa, in South Africa, there hasn't been that much progress. It's not written down now, but they see that racial divide even in people's mindsets.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you look in the U.S. now, you're getting people getting, you know, people getting shot, people getting killed, and, you know, no one bets an eye. You know, they talk about it here and there. Then next week, we focus on something else. And it's just become such a norm that people got to a point where just, like, you get numb. It's like every week there's a black person dying in the United States. Now, that's not the case in the U.K., and that's not the case in South Africa now. But the struggles are different.
Well, Charles, I think you've given a lot of perspective on this, and certainly I don't know if it's encouraging or if it's, you know, just really pointing out that when we think it's just an issue right here in our own backyard, this is, again, you know, another theme of thinking, you know, we've got problems here in the U.S., but, you know, there's some deep-rooted same issues in different ways in other parts of the world as well.
I guess the challenge really is this talk of how do we fix these problems? You know, people going on you know, social media, putting black squares, and, you know, you see all of that, and that's beautiful. But I feel like the history needs to be taught as a whole. All school curriculums are quite selective of the things that they want to teach and just brush on either slavery or people not really versed in it. It's a long way to go. I think one of the most effective ways as well is confronting our actions and the institutions we have in place, be it by, you know, protesting, going out there and be active on the streets, is going to help challenge these racial ideologies we have around.
I appreciate it, Charles. Really, it's not an easy conversation, but it has to be had. And it's nice to be able to be vulnerable, coming from just from my point of view and trying to learn and be educated, but also to be able to ask questions without being shot down or feeling like, you know, I'm ignorant. I appreciate you, you know, opening up and being able to give insight on this. It really means a lot.
I appreciate this too, Melissa, because, you know, you are asking the question. It's good to have that dialogue, right? Because it's a constructive dialogue. You're trying to build a better world. That's how it all starts. It starts with the communities that you're in, the families that you're in, and you grow from there.
Talking right now to one of my childhood friends, Andrew Heath, who was born and raised in Stamford, now living out on the West Coast. Andrew, thanks for being here this morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Andrew now is living and working out in Oakland, California. So first of all, Andrew, what do you do for a living?
So I started my own basketball training company called Andrew Heath Basketball, training kids from young as like 5-6 years old up to professional players. And then doing camps and clinics and stuff like that. I had the opportunity to do some stuff internationally as well, too. And then also work at a high school in San Francisco, kind of a dual role as an admissions director and an athletic director.
Before you even moved out west, the reason you actually left Connecticut was because you fell in love while you were overseas. Why were you in China for 3 years?
I had the fortunate opportunity to play and coach basketball in Beijing for 3 years. So I was playing for this team called the Beijing Panthers. We played in the league called the Wild Ball League, which is the system that plays all over the country. And then at the same time, I was coaching for NBA academies and for international high schools.
That is so cool. You've been so amazing to be able to follow your dream and be able to pursue basketball professionally. So before I even get into what it was like being overseas, talk about growing up here in Connecticut.
Well, first, I think once you leave Connecticut, people always ask if I grew up on a farm or something, but not at all that type of lifestyle. I grew up in Stamford. It's a pretty diverse area compared to what most people perceive Connecticut to be. I grew up in a biracial household. My father's white, my mother's black. Stamford definitely had kids that were more welcoming than other parts, but for the most part, I mean, people got along. Definitely most of my friends have been people of color, and it's not like I purposely have chosen that. It's been just more life experiences and like the little things that shape your friend group. I do have white friends, but I guess you would classify them as people who just kind of see the world in a different way. People bring up stuff that you don't really see as an issue. You meet some friends, you see their parents might be different than your parents, but it isn't really a big thing. And that was kind of my experience as like a young kid too. You obviously realize like mom and dad don't look alike. It's not until you go to school and other kids have questions like, how could your parents even do it? Like what type of person like does that? Or how did your parents even like get the courage up to like create you? So just questions like that start, okay, cool. Like the world views this as different or as a problem. And then it definitely like just shapes how you just walk around and experience life.
Now, did you find that it was the same when you went overseas?
Yeah, so it was the two, kind of a funny note, people called me Steph Curry when I was over there. So everyone was always like, oh, you look like Steph Curry. And I would say that one of the main differences I realized from like being overseas to like just living in the States and growing up in the States, racism's everywhere. Like, you're not going to avoid it, unfortunately. Like, that's just a thing that you're just going to encounter. But it wasn't to the same degree or intensity that it is here. When I was over there, I had this big afro, so people definitely had questions and the typical stuff like, can I touch it and all that, but never felt threatened. It wasn't as severe as this here, and there weren't ever moments of you didn't feel like you couldn't go places. You would definitely walk in somewhere and probably get stares and maybe get some type of looks, but it wasn't here where you hear stories about people getting kicked out or people getting beat up or threatened or anything like that.
What would be your hope for the United States then, at least to tackle the U.S. and make things better?
I think it all comes down to education. We're just tired of just this, the same repeating story, and it's just time for other communities to wake up and see it. And these are things that the Black community has been talking about forever. There's been movies, stand-ups, books. These are conversations that we've been having since we came to this country. And just throughout history, it's stuff that we've been trying to bring to light. So it's great seeing that all these marches and protests are going on, but I want to see this same energy and mindset like a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, because that's where change is going to come. In a year or two from now, if we're just at the dinner table, if I just bring up this recent book I read about race issues or stuff, don't just pass it off and try to change the subject. Like, hear out what I have to say. And then, yeah, I think that's just how we're going to grow.
You know, this is an issue that obviously is very deep for people of color, but it's also something that people with disabilities, you know, we don't talk about that. We don't talk about people with broken families who are raised by one parent. We don't talk about people of the LGBTQ community. We don't talk about a lot of stuff.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Andrew, I appreciate you weighing in on the conversation. Good luck out there. I hope to see you really soon. And I appreciate you being able to give us this insight this morning.
Well, thank you. Thank you again for having me on. And tell the family I said hello.
Speaking this morning with Aubrey Lowe, she's a lieutenant in the Air Force. She's actually stationed at Robins Air Force Base in Georgia. And I know Aubrey because she's a Stratford native and also an alum from Laurelton Hall. So, Aubrey, thanks for being here this morning. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. So, Aubrey, tell us a little bit about your background and what you're doing now for work.
I am currently working in aircraft maintenance. I'm a supervisory role. So I manage people, logistics, equipment, schedules, that kind of stuff to make sure that aircraft are prepared to go up in the air for when pilots and other flyers take them to do whatever missions they need to do. We have a large range of missions and things that kind of get done, but we just want to make sure that anyone who takes that jet is 100% safe.
That's incredible. And first of all, thank you for serving our country. I very much appreciate
it. Absolutely. My pleasure.
Are there moments in your life as a child or during the academy or even now at work where you have been in situations where you've been either targeted or treated differently because of the color of your skin?
So as a child, you know, you don't really recognize skin color as much, because that's just not the frame of mind you've been necessarily taught, you know? So the first experience I can think of, I was 8 when it happened, or taking the CMTs, you know, that great test every year. And I'm sitting there and we're going through those initial questions on that first page. And I was like, do I pick black or white for my race? And it says select only one. So I'm sitting here looking at this paper, like, which one do I pick? And I go up and I ask my teacher, which one do I pick? And she was like, whatever one you want, like whatever one you feel comfortable with. And I go back to my seat, I end up skipping the question and finishing the whole test and sitting there at the end, just looking at this one check mark, like it was the hardest question in the entire pamphlet at 8 years old. And I just didn't at that time truly understand, like, for me being both black and white, what that kind of meant to me. And so I think that kind of started off my whole identity search and figuring out, like, what being half and half really meant to me. Mm-hmm. And then kind of moving through, like, high school and stuff, there were a handful of times where you come into, like, really, really small instances, but they end up impacting you a lot. So there were some pictures for, like, a publicity thing for Laurelton about who was all going to be included and everything. And they'd asked me to be a part of the pictures, and I was just like, sure, whatever. Doesn't really matter to me. I didn't really bring any attention to it. And then we're taking these pictures, and the lady who was taking them kept mentioning me and another student as, like, token. And she would, like, yeah, let's put our token in this picture. And, like, I understand from a publicity standpoint, you want to show the inclusion that you're trying to portray of your school, and I really get that. But at the same time, like, it felt super insensitive to me. Like, the only reason I'm here is not as a representative of the school, but now I'm just looked at as a skin color. And I think that was kind of one of those big, powerful moments of, like, is this all people actually see of me? Because if you were to look at me personally, yeah, I'm like tan and I've got super curly hair. But outside of that, like, to me, I'm a person, and it's moments like those that you start realizing that other people will look at you and make assumptions.
Those are, like you said, there's those little moments that I don't even think people know about, and you carry those for a really long time.
Yeah, it's been 7 years since I happened.
Yeah. Wow. And, you know, I have to point out the fact, Aubrey, that, you know, certainly I don't want to cast a full shadow on just one state or that it's the entire place. But, you know, immediately when I learned that you were going to be stationed in Georgia, I have to be honest, I was really nervous about that, because there's a lot of racial issues in the South, mm-hmm. in the Deep South. You know, you do still find that still exists. Do you find that you are facing that challenge?
So right now, because of kind of a lot more of the shutdown, I haven't had, like, a large interaction with a lot of people down here. I've only been here for, like, 2 months or so, but I completely get that feeling. The community that I live in right now is extremely mixed in racial differences and in age, which I know is definitely a portion of this as well, and what people have experienced themselves and what they're used to, what they grew up with. I definitely still get a little nervous depending on where I go and what people have told me about certain areas of where I live. And I agree with some of that stuff. It's a little bit nerve-wracking, because you stand there like, if I go out today, is someone going to say something to me? And how defensive am I going to have to be? And how am I going to have to hold myself or protect myself or protect, like, my loved ones and stuff? So I just kind of get a little on edge most times when I go out, you know, as people start to have some more of these difficult conversations and start understanding each other and why they feel certain ways. I'm hoping this kind of dies down.
What would be your hope at this point to be able to bridge gaps that we're seeing when it comes to people of color and the rest of society?
I think that conversation piece is the biggest thing, and that's from every side. I can talk about my perspective as being half black, half white. So I'm blue in the face, because that's been my life, and that's the same with any other person of color. And at the same time, that's any person who's white as well. And being able to understand where everyone's coming from and what makes them frustrated with the state of the world right now and the state of our country, I think is a little bit easier to kind of group our thoughts. Sometimes I feel like one side is so stuck in their ways that they're not willing to fully have a conversation, not just talk at the other person. So I think that if we can all sit down wherever to be able to talk with each other is going to be the way forward, and hopefully see some change, not just in the small little groups, but eventually all over the world. Because, you know, think about the 6 degrees of separation. Like, you could be having this conversation with one person and something you say could spark something in someone else and carry that, you know, hundreds of people down the line, depending on who talks to each other. So I'd really like to see that as we continue to go through this movement.
Chatting this morning with Rayon Graham, who used to work at News 12 Connecticut with me. He was a photographer there. He has now gone out west to NBC San Diego, where he is a photographer there. And Rayon, thanks for being here this morning. How are you?
Thank you, Melissa, for allowing me to come on the show.
How has news been lately?
To tell you the truth, it's nerve-wracking a little bit. Every day I wake up and I'm like, what is next? And when I say that, I'm being truthful. I don't know what is next. And yeah, that's part of the adventure as well, too, as I spoke about. But it's the fact that I don't know. I wake up and I see, I look at the news as well, too, and I try not to just watch one news. I watch all different newscasts to get a broad understanding of what is going on in the world, you know, because we can't be biased as news people. We have to try to be as open to everything to understand. And for me, it's hard. Sometimes I've said it before where, like, I really wanted to cry because it was so tragic for me knowing that all these people have passed, whether it was from hands of police or whether it's from the hands of other people in the community who are doing harm to the community itself. I just feel like I could be next. My brother could be next. My uncle, my dad, someone in my family, someone I know could be next. And it's just that, knowing the fact that if you think about it at heart and you think that person could be next or yourself, like, what do you think about and how do you settle your mind every day knowing that you have to constantly look over your shoulder? And I don't like that fact.
Yeah, that's honestly something, Ray, that I don't know if a lot of people can relate to. And for anyone who can't pick up on Ray's accent, which I absolutely love, Ray is originally from Jamaica. And he came over to the United States. And Ray, talk a little bit about what you noticed from the time that you were born, came over to America, settled here. You've moved a couple of times for different stations. What have you experienced through the years?
Growing up in Jamaica, it was kind of one-sided kind of knowledge because I've never been anywhere besides Jamaica for the first 10 years of my life. And that's all I knew. So I didn't know what it was out here. Yeah, you can watch TV and watch news, but like, it doesn't bring any that much perspective into your life until you actually start living it. Coming to America, I saw it a little different. And yeah, I basically grew up in Bridgeport, which is a more black folks, Mexican folks, a lot of Spanish people that live there. It's a melted pot, basically. You have a lot of different cultures in Bridgeport. But driving 20 minutes down the road to Fairfield University, it was kind of a culture shock in a sense. I knew what I was getting into a little bit, but I didn't expect the full thing going there. That school, I think, was like 90% white folks going to the school. And every day I felt safe, but it's just that there are times when there are moments that really hit me. And I was like, wow, I didn't expect that. And those things are what kind of like took me out a little bit, you know. And every day now, like, I have to constantly look over my shoulder of like, what is going on and how am I feeling? And I have to literally like calm myself down just because knowing that I live in a country that everyone don't understand what is going on, and whether they don't understand it, whether they refuse to understand it, or whether they have an open mind to know what's going on. And the thing that kind of beats me now, being that I have traveled from different station to station, is that you go in different areas and people treat you differently in different areas. I was in Vermont with you for I know it's short, but like 6 months, and we mm-hmm. worked together at 10 or 12 before. But there, personally, I've never experienced any type of hatred towards me, whether it's any type of big issue where people don't understand or refuse to acknowledge the difference. And for me, like, I didn't feel any type of way there.
Which is interesting because Vermont is like one of the whitest states in the country. So that's interesting
Yeah, it is. And to me, everybody there was welcoming. Yeah, I would go into different rural areas here and there. I would get a slight little look and stuff. But there's not a lot of black people that do live in Vermont. But it's the fact that everyone that I've seen so far were very welcoming. The thing is that gets me is the fact that people say, I don't see color. And I think that you have to understand and you have to see color to know the difference between what privilege you have as a white person, whether you're male or female, and the non-privilege that someone of color, someone that is black, someone that is brown, someone that is different, that is not white, does not have. If you say, I don't see color, then I think you're trying to be neutral in a sense. And I understand maybe you don't know. And this is the way to correct that or to help you to understand better. Because if you look at a red rose and a white rose and a pink rose, they're all different colors. But guess what? They're all a rose in the same family. Mm. It's just that they have different color. And yeah, you might prefer a red rose versus a white rose versus a pink rose. But at the end of the day, they're all in the rose family and they're all beautiful. And you love them no matter what. You just have a favorite color that you choose. You have to understand that my skin, I have a lot more pigment in my skin than someone else. That doesn't make me better than the person. And it doesn't make me less than that person. Right now with the Black Lives Movement, people say all lives matter. And I think the thing about that is that we are saying that Black Lives Matter. It's not taken away from anyone else, from white folks, from Asian folks, from Spanish folks. We're not taking away from anyone else's and saying that no other people matter. It's the fact that there is systemic racism and there is a lot of bigotry and there's a lot of hate in America. Mm-hmm. And another example of that is the fact that if you live on a street, your house is burning down and your neighbor lives 5-6 houses down the street. That person's house that is being burned down is going to affect the community, right? Whether it's going to spread from one house to the next. But for the time being, only that one house is on fire. And if I come and say, hey, my house is on fire, can you get help for me? And a person say, oh, no, all houses on the street matter. It's like, yeah, we understand that. It all matters. But at the time right now, my house is on fire.
Right.
And if my house does not get help, my house will spread to the next house and the next house and eventually spread to your house. So we have to focus on the issue at hand and then from that issue move forward to the next problem and to the next problem and to the next issue. And that is how we're going to be able to fix this world.
Yeah, that's so true. It's so true, Ray. Well, I appreciate your insight and being able to explain this to our listeners this morning. Thank you so much.
Yeah, definitely. I appreciate you bringing me on and I appreciate you allowing me to speak from the heart because these things are big issues.
And excited to be able to talk to this next guest. In fact, you may recognize his voice very well. It's Juan Castillo, who you probably know as a host at 94.3 WYBC. He's also the program director there, our sister station here through Connoisseur Media. And Juan, thanks for being here this morning. How are you?
Thank you. How you doing?
I can't complain, Juan. I mean, well, I can. There's certainly a lot going on in the world right now, which is why you're here and certainly giving some insight to our listeners this morning. First and foremost, well done the other day when you had your Face Nation with Channel 3 Eyewitness News. I thought you guys did a great job talking and doing a roundtable with the governor and many other state leaders. So thank you for doing that. That was awesome.
Yep. Thank you. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, Juan, first of all, I know that you've been obviously in this industry for a very, very long time. What have you noticed, covered on the air, talked about over the years? And do you think that we have progressed as a nation?
Well, I mean, I think that, we've got to look at history here. I mean, pretty much, what happened If you go back to 1968, when Martin Luther King was murdered, and the country pretty much went through what it's going through right now.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Luther King was a person that, was very much about nonviolence and really was able to take Gandhi's whole process of nonviolence to another level. And what he did was he was able to convince the nation that it was important to pass legislation that was going to, you know, help in terms of just, you know, equality for everyone, right? And he was about everyone. It wasn't just about black people, but for everybody. Mm-hmm. And when he got murdered, the country erupted, and it burned, you know. So, like, it was really, like, crazy because that's not what he was about. Obviously, that's kind of what happened this time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened then was that the country woke up and said, okay, you know what? We've got to pass a lot of legislation that's going to provide, you know, minorities and especially black people with a hand up, not a hand down, hand out, but a hand up. And so affirmative action programs came in. The country focused on trying to work with the poor and so forth and so on. And so we progressed as a nation in the terms of, like, you know, a lot of poor people and especially black people were able to get into the middle class and get new jobs and that they weren't able to get before, mm-hmm. and so forth and so on. I think what happened was that since then, right, we've had a political structure that has allowed for all of those things that happened then to be taken away. Civil rights commissions and things like that were taken away. Affirmative action went out the door. And so what we found is that at this point, and what's interesting is that back then, a lot of the violence and a lot of the racism was down south, right? Mm-hmm. Somehow the North was a little bit more progressive. Well, what happened here was that because of a lot of policies and procedures within police departments and military racist police departments, the growth of minorities living in big cities. What happened was that the police department began to have all this power. Their union, extremely, extremely powerful in every city, where a police officer can commit anything and he's not liable for it. I mean, right now, one of the biggest fights that are going to happen in Congress and in every city is, limited immunity, big issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I got a gun, and I'm able to use that gun any way I want to, because I know that I'm not going to be held liable, right? And so I could lose my job, but I find another job. I go over to the next police department and work over there, right? That's going to give people that might have an attitude about black people or about anybody else.
Right.
And let me say this. I've worked in law enforcement. You know, I was a parole officer for 20 years.
No,
right?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And you know, and I was a supervisor also, right? Look, if you and I went through this with a lot of my officers, right, including black officers, right? If you're coming into a neighborhood that you didn't grow up in, and for 15 years, you know, you are going on calls where all you see is black people and Hispanics, you know, committing these crimes, and that's all you see, right? You know, you're in the inner city, New Haven. You're not in Brantford, right? And this is what you're doing every day, right?
Mm-hmm.
After a while, you start having an attitude. I had attitudes I had problems with black officers who were treating black people worse than the white ones, right? Because mm-hmm. they became desensitized to the issue, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So now, if you add to a white person who has that job, and he's already came in with a little racist attitude, and you add that to it, it's volatile, right?
Sure. Oh, yeah, sure.
And so you got to take a real good look at that.
Mm-hmm.
I think at this point, you know, with all the protests, and, you know, the protests are going to continue, right? Because, you know, the only way we're going to change things in this country is for legislators, mayors, police chiefs, everyone has to understand that you have to get to policies and procedures.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look at how you supervise your police officer. It's a lot of power when you got a gun.
Oh, right? Absolutely. Yes.
Extreme.
Yes.
A lot of power. And uh-huh. It's a psychological thing too. Like, you know, when I used to carry a gun working, right? It's like when I put that gun on and I went out into the street, it's like, you know, I had this edge, right? That was like, okay, I know that I could protect myself, but I also know I'm a badass.
Right. I'm sure you felt like also there's just like a status, you know, just knowing that you're wearing the uniform, you've got the badge. There's also a status that goes with it, you know. That helps too.
But I mean, I think between the legislation and trying to change that, but then also, right, on top of that, right, you know, we have to, you know, like one of the things that I've seen lately that's been really good is that, you know, some cities are passing legislation where police officers, when they go out to deal with mental health issues on a call, it's a mental health call, right? Somebody's got a mental health problem, that they are taking some mental health professionals with them, but you have to now, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, sure. Yeah, I mean, the governor I know yesterday just signed that executive order, and de-escalation training was extensive in it for our state police, which exactly what you said with mental health patients or just anybody who's maybe not even being violent, but just having those tactics in place, that needs to be in place for all police departments for sure.
Right. But in addition to that, I think that, you know, there is the issue of the fact that, and I think America finally realizes this, right? For years, we've been telling America as black people, look, it's not just about the fact that you're beating me up and you're killing me, right? But it's like it's a psychological issue. I mean, I tell people this all the time. I'm 6'3", okay? I'm a big guy, always been a big guy, right?
Yeah.
Like my whole life, right? It's like, and I lived in New York City where it's supposed to be so progressive, right? You know?
Right.
I grew up in New York City. The whole idea of being able of walking up to an elevator and having people let you get in the elevator first because they're afraid that you're going to, and I'm wearing a 3-piece Armani suit, right? You're worried that I'm going to stick you up. Just that attitude, right?
Yeah.
After a while, that builds and it builds and it builds and it builds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you live with that, you know, you've heard all the stories, right? Every time, look, I was a parole officer, and as a parole officer, I was driving up. I got a badge. I'm driving a state car, and I'm getting stopped 25, 30 times in a month.
Wow,
right?
Okay? That's crazy.
You know, and so and now, you know, when I'm driving and I see and I hear police siren behind me, I tense up. Right? I
mean, sure,
that's
of course.
No way to live, right?
And
so
no,
having
no.
said that, right? Okay, so how do you change things, right? Now, you know, I was the other day I said this and someone said to me, well, you can't change so what's in somebody's heart. Oh, I get that, right?
Mm.
Let me tell you what my feeling is. I went to all black high school. I didn't get a chance to even be friends with any white people until I went to college, right? Notre Dame University in South Bend, Indiana. Right. Mm-hmm. It's the first time. Right. So over the years, like, you know, it was hard for me to relate to white people because I didn't know them. Right. Only on television, to be honest with you. Right. So as life went on and I became, you know, sophisticated to some degree. Right. And I realized that, look, you know, like, all white people are not racist, and all black people are not criminals, right?
Right.
Okay. I realized that, okay, you know, I got to give people a chance, right? Okay, so my best friend, you know, is Anthony Brooks, who used to be my program director.
Mm-hmm.
And when I hired him as program director for Urban Station, right, people asked me, why would you hire a white guy to do urban radio? Well, because this white guy knows more about urban radio than anybody I know,
wow,
right?
Yeah.
He knows all the artists. He knows everything, right? He's a great programmer, whatever. We became very, very good. That's my best friend,
mm-hmm,
right?
Yeah.
He asked me the other day, Juan, what can we do? So, you know, I said to him, look, there's nothing that we can do, not me and you, right? Because we're showing America what it's all about, right?
Right. You guys are proof in the pudding, right? Absolutely.
Right. Mm-hmm. But would you know what you need to do? And, of course, he does it, right? But he said, but this is what white America has to do. White America has got to have a conversation with white America. Mm-hmm. We've been having conversations all these years,
right,
with black America and white America and brown people. The conversation needs to happen between white people. If you, Melissa, believe that racism is not any good and you got a friend or you got an acquaintance that wants to talk that nonsense to you, right, you need to call them out.
Mm-hmm.
You need to try to change them and their right. attitude because they can relate to you, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we change America, right?
That's true.
That's the core of it all,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so let me say this. You know what? I'm very encouraged and optimistic about America and where we're going. And you know why? Because, I mean, we're doing like 11 graduations this week. Like,
I know.
Unprecedented, right?
Yeah.
You know,
y'all are busy.
You know, we're doing virtual graduations for all of the New Haven high schools, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I've had a chance to really get to talk to and to deal with these students, right, in preparation for all of this. And this generation don't care about race. They don't.
Mm-hmm.
This generation, look at them, right? Millennials and these young people today, they're showing America what it's all about, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't.
Yeah.
They are going to create change in this country because they are serious about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people that are out protesting. Those are the people who are saying, hey, no more, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I'm very encouraged. You know, Kent State in 1968 changed America because white kids were killed. You know, And so America decided that, okay, you know what? We got to stop this now, right?
Right, right.
Okay, you know, I grew up in Panama, right? I came here when I was 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I used to watch young people in Panama do the same thing that they're doing that's happening here, right? And Panama was changed because of that, right?
Yeah, that's amazing.
And so
yeah.
I'm extremely encouraged and optimistic about where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
But don't get it twisted. It's all about legislation. You know, you can't raise a kid if you don't have rules and policies.
Right, exactly. There's no order in the house, absolutely, unless you make
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but
yeah.
But again,
wow.
You know, I think that it all came at one time. I think mm-hmm. that it's interesting because coronavirus came in and said, you know what, I don't care what color you are. This is a virus that anybody can get,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
But it also showed. I mean, we went through weeks and weeks of coverage where why are black people getting coronavirus, and you know, and dying the most?
Yes.
Right?
Yep. They were the highest.
So,
yeah. Uh huh.
And so the socioeconomic and health you know disparities all of a sudden became paramount, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like. Then you started having conversations about, well, you know, the election can't, you know, it's about black people voting, right? Like,
that's what it's become now. Yeah, that's what it's become now.
It's important for black people to vote because
yeah.
they're going to make the change, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then, you know, George Floyd happened, right? And so it's like black people are the conversation right now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we definitely have to keep that conversation really going. Juan, I so appreciate you giving us this insight this morning and just taking the time to talk about this in depth. Really, really awesome perspective. Thank you so much.
One love, Melissa. One love. That's what's going to change it too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Love, man.
Amen
that's what
to
I'm
that.
Talking about.
I agree.
Right.
I agree. Thank you so much, brother. I appreciate that.
Stop waking me up early in the morning.
I'll try 8 o'clock next time. I promise. I'll try 8 o'clock. I promise.
Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too. That's Juan Castillo.